many people still struggling with sleepiness and monkey mind. So after having sort of sat still for, you know, a long period of time, so now we're gonna take a walk on the wild side. Means I'm gonna give a talk on the simile of the raft, which is a kind of a little story about how the average person tries to live their life, then encounters all kinds of difficulties and problems, and then how they use the Dhamma to help them to cross the river of life, you know, in their own mind. So, you know, try to follow along and sort of imagine yourself. So, you know, on a certain Saturday or Sunday, on a nice summer's day, the average person, whether they're in Ottawa or New York or L.A., or, you know, they go out to the countryside, you know, just minding their own business, you know, wanting to enjoy the day, and go for a walk. So they start walking out in the countryside, and all of a sudden, you know, there's a strong earthquake, and the ground shakes and starts to split open some cracks, and the person gets scared, and the hair stands up on the head, and they run and jump over some cracks, and eventually the earthquake stops, and they sort of escape any danger from that, and they go, whew. And then they keep on walking. And then a little bit later, then comes a tsunami. And a big flood. And they run and run and get away from those the waves. And finally that subsides. And again they go, whew. And they keep on walking. And they walk into the forest. And then all of a sudden a big forest fire, a raging fire like they're having out in Colorado now or some places in the States. And they get terrified by that and they run and run and run and finally get away from the fire. And again they go, whew. And then we get out of the forest, out in the open again, and then all of a sudden a big tornado comes, wind, uprooting trees and blowing everything around, and they hunker down until that goes off. And again, whew, you know, they survive those four storms. And then they keep on walking. And then some bandits, the robbers, jump out from behind the trees and rocks and chase them with the sword. And they run, run to get away from the robbers. And they see a small village. They run into the village to get help. The village is empty, nobody home. Nobody to get help. And then they see a ghost. The hair stands on end, and they run out of the village, and they, you know, keep running and running and looking around, see what other kind of danger is following them. And then they come to a river, and they look on the other side of the river. They see, look, everything looks nice and peaceful on the other side, with palm trees blowing in the breeze, coconut trees, and so on. And they say, oh, if I can only get to the other side, I'll get free from these dangers. but can't swim. And then the bat. Mokurakaran. Can't swim, what to do? So he looks around and then, he sees 8 logs stuck in the mud of the river. So an idea springs into his mind. He says, if I can pull these logs out and tie them together, I can make a raft and go across the river to the other side in safety. So still looking around to see if any dangers are coming, he, great difficulty, he pulls the logs out, and that big sucking sound, when you're pulling a log or something out of the wet mud. He pulls them out, puts them side by side. With great effort, he pulls them out. Then he looks around and he sees some creeper in the trees, some vines. So he cuts some to tie them together. He ties the logs together and makes a raft. And then again, with strong effort, he pulls the raft down to the edge of the river and he gets onto the raft and he starts paddling. And finally he's out in the river and he feels some relief that from the dangers of that other shore. But as he's paddling, he gets bit by a crocodile. And he has to be mindful and trying to get away from the crocodiles. Then as he gets out toward the middle of the river, there's some whirlpools going like that. And he has to miss those to avoid getting sucked down in the whirlpool. So again, mindfully, with effort, he avoids those. And then there's a sandbar out in the middle where he could get stuck on a sandbar. So again, with mindfulness and effort, he avoids getting stuck on the sandbar. And finally, he gets over to the other shore, near to the other shore. But then there's submerged tree trunks and branches just near the shore that could prevent the raft from actually getting to the shore. So with the effort and mindfulness, he finds some spot where the branches are not too thick or too up to the surface, and he finally gets to the shore and he gets off. The raft, and the raft's very heavy, so he doesn't carry it out around on his head, but he thanks the raft for its, carrying him to the safety. And he looks around and he sees, these fruit trees, papaya and coconut trees, mango trees laden with fruit. And he, plucks the fruit and enjoys the fruit. And then he takes a little walk up onto a hill. And he can get a 360-degree panorama. And he builds himself a little hut. And then sits down and lives happily ever after. So that's sort of the story. Now, how does this relate to us in the practice of the Dhamma? Well, each of us are like that person, who just wants to try to enjoy life, tries to live free from danger and pain, mind their own business. What symbolized the earthquake? The earthquake, tsunami, fire, and tornado. So these symbolize the 4 elements. Now, earthquake, fire, flood, tornado, these are the external 4 elements. But we have these four elements inside of our body also. And the body is comprised of these four elements. And they're also impermanent. And they're always changing. And they're always erupting, like the earthquakes and the tsunami, to cause us pain. So the body is beset with aging, old age, sickness, disease. You know, the organs degenerate, get broken bones, all kinds of subject to viruses and diseases and pains. So people experience this to some degree or more, throughout their whole life. Or the people are not satisfied with their bodies, what nature gave them, and they want to change them. But anyway, so all kinds of problems arise in this body due to many different kinds of causes and conditions to bring suffering. So people are living in fear of that. They're living in fear of getting sick, living in fear of getting old, and of course the fear of death. And especially nowadays with the advancement of science and the human, NOMI project, and all the classification of genes, and how a person, they can get a genetic card or whatever it is, and to match it up with their parents, and then they realize, they have the genes of their parents or relatives who have cancer or some other horrible disease, and then they start worrying and having fear and anxiety about, am I going to, get Alzheimer's or, Parkinson's disease or whatever it might be that, might be in your family's history or, when they're getting older, wanting to hide the realities of old age and death. When they're, or especially of old age, when their hair starts turning gray, they want to, diet some color to hide the reality of getting old. And so people are living in these kind of fears, or they're actually experiencing, the pains of the impermanence of the body, or living in the fear of the future, of the pains that they imagine they might suffer. So that incurs a lot of stress and anxiety for people. So they, they try to, to escape that by, indulging in other types of sensual desires or pleasures, or, trying to anyway cover up or avoid, to try to hide the reality about the old age, sickness and death, which they might be able to kind of mask for a while, but sooner or later there's no way of stopping those realities. So anyway, people are living in that kind of fear. And then the five robbers, what do the five robbers represent? Even if some people are not maybe experiencing a lot of problems with their body and so on, but the five robbers represent the five aggregates. The five aggregates are what the Buddha defined as, the suffering, in his definition of suffering. The Buddha defines suffering as three levels, the old age, sickness, and death, and then not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, and then in short, he said the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. And that basically means all of our states of body and mind and all the objects in the material world. And the four elements, of course, are not limited to our physical body, but all material things in the world. So the death and sickness of our loved ones causes us grief and anxiety and fear and the loss of our material possessions. They can be stolen, or your house can burn down or get blown away by a tornado. You can see this on the news almost every day in some part of the world. There's death and destruction by the impermanence of the elements. Almost every day people are dying either in earthquakes, floods, fires, tornadoes, hurricanes, so many other types of natural disasters. So this is not a fantasy, it's something that's very, very real. But anyway, so the five rabbas are basically are aggregates that are constantly changing, our feelings, perceptions, mental states, our moods, and consciousness, and basically changing beyond our control. Most people don't have control. The painful feelings arise, they try to push them away, they can't prevent them. Or they have pleasurable feelings that they want to hold on to, but because of impermanence, they disappear. So people are trying to hold on to what brings them pleasure, but because of impermanence, it changes. Or they're having fear of painful things coming to them, so they worry and get anxious about the future imagined unpleasant feelings connected with the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and the body, or even the mind. And your mental states come and go also, not being able to control them. You feel sadness, and you feel happiness, you feel confusion, you feel people suffer from depression, so many other various types of mental states. And they can't really control them very well. And they're due to causes and conditions. So the five robbers with swords waiting to cut off the head means these aggregates, when they're changing and we can't really control them, and they bring us lots of pain. Or, people, their perceptions change, and like the story of, you see a rope coiled up and you imagine it's a Naya, a serpent. You get scared, and then, you realize it was just a rope, And so people's minds are constantly projecting things that are not really real, and they get lost in their perceptions and spend lots of time needlessly fearing and worrying and have anxiety for things that they think or imagine are going to happen in the future. And some of those things may happen, but many of them don't happen. And how much time have you spent, worrying about things that actually never came to pass, that you thought that they were, but they didn't. So anyway, so it is to escape from all this impermanence and pain of the changing of the aggregates of the body and the mind, people escape into sensual pleasure. And they empty, so they run into the village to escape the dangers of impermanence and no self, or especially impermanence, anicca and dukkha. They run into the village thinking there's a cinema there. Go to the movies. Run to a village thinking there's some discotheque, or to buy some drugs, or get some alcohol, or whatever. It means that the village stands for the six senses, indulging in sensual pleasure. So people, to escape the pain and the suffering they might experience, they rush into the village of the world, the six senses, in order to try to stimulate and find some escape from their pain by indulging in the six senses, by whatever means available. But even the pleasures of the six senses, they might get some temporary relief from their pain, but then it comes back again. And they can't really, sort of control it. Or the pleasure, lasts only so long, wears off, then they have to get something else. And they go on grasping after one sense pleasure after another. But because of impermanence, none of that lasts. And so they realize that they can't control anything. So the village is, the Buddha gives that the simile of an empty house with no one at home. That means the six senses, they can't really provide any lasting pleasure because of their impermanent nature, because the objects of the world are impermanent, and even our mind is impermanent, changing all of its desires, and it's very fickle and always changing, and not being able to stay concentrated on any one thing, jumping around. So then the ghost, what's the ghost? Sees a ghost. That means he understands there's no one controlling this body and mind. He thinks he's in control, or she thinks she's in control, but actually nothing can be controlled, because everything is undergoing constant impermanence, all the activities of the body and mind, inside as well as in the world around. And so that condition is what actually draws people toward, various types of dharmas or religions. And so to escape from all that pain and anxiety, worry and fear, again, people then they get attracted to religion. So people turn to religion. For many people, people only get religious when traumatic things happen in their life. When everything is going, very nicely and there's no problems, and they just allow themselves to get carried away and consumed in thinking the world is a perfect place. But sooner or later, that's going to fall apart. Or only when the people experience some tragedy, like Kisa Gotami or Patachara, these famous stories in the Buddha suttas, then the people turn to religion or dharma for some time of help. And so that's this person running away from the village, and then he sees the broad river, and he keeps looking around, sees the danger on this side and sees the peacefulness of the other side. So that's like hearing some Dhamma. Like for a lot of us, especially Westerners who weren't born in a Buddhist country, I speak for myself, when you first heard the Dhamma, it was like, wow, this is something new, I haven't heard this before. What is this? Meditation, the mind, suffering, nirvana. So, gets him interested to find out something more. And so, then like seeing the eight logs, okay? So the eight logs, I'm sure you can all guess what that represents, right? Anybody? Right, the Noble Eightfold Path, right? So they hear about the Noble Eightfold Path. And faith springs up into their heart. That's like the idea, he sees the eight logs, yes, I can build a raft. And so he gets a lot of energy. So that faith that there's actually some logs there gives him the energy to try to pull them out. So this awakens the five spiritual faculties on hearing the Dhamma and about a new possibility and a way to live and think and meditate. That awakens the spiritual faculties of faith and energy are the first two spiritual faculties. Without that, that person could never pull the logs out. But that initial faith gives him the effort to pull the logs out. He gets the logs out, then, you know, how to put them together. So the creeper up in the trees represents wisdom. You know, the right understanding. And with that he ties the logs together. Then again, more effort pulls the raft and launches it into the river. That means starting one's Dhamma practice. Now you might have thought that's the hard part. No, that's probably the easy part. Now, once he starts, he's on the raft, right? Or she. Excuse me if I use the word he all the time. Could be both, right? So, you know, he starts paddling, then he gets bit by a crocodile. Ay. What's a crocodile stand for? It stands for, again, for sensual pleasures. Because even when people are trying to practice the Dhamma, and even though they know sensual pleasures have little to offer, still, they haven't discovered or reached the deeper level of happiness within. So the lure and temptation of sensual pleasures still comes to attack them. Or because they haven't really firmly cemented their faith in the Dhamma, they can get bit and caught by the lure of the sensual pleasures. And so this is where mindfulness, the next three spiritual faculties, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, play the important part to guide that raft now that you're actually on the water. You know, that means starting the sort of the spiritual life, or the life of Dhamma. Then you have to avoid these, once you start meditating, now you're going into the river of the mind. Before you launch the raft on the physical water, but now with the meditation you're going in and crossing the river of the mind. And that's a whole different thing. Crossing the physical river is easy if you know how to swim, if you have a good boat. But crossing the river of the mind is more difficult. And it's this mind that steers the boat, you know, the body. So anyway, so you have to be aware of the sort of the lures and temptations of the sensual pleasure. This is why the precepts are important. Like, you know, you start to have eyes for somebody else's husband or wife or boyfriend or girlfriend, and you know, or like some other unskillful sexual type of craving and so on, or other types of indulgences, then you have to be mindful of not to get caught into those. And then the whirlpools, so you manage to somehow, you know, not to get too much stuck in negative sensual types of craving. But then the whirlpools, what do those represent? Well, there are the other conflicting emotions such as jealousy, envy, fear, hatred, anger, other emotional states. It can, you know, like you get suck the mind down, pull the mind down, or like depression, going into deep depression, or some other types of mental psychotic states that, pull our consciousness down. So we have to, again, avoid or to maintain, strengthen our mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, and by developing our meditation practice. This is where developing, mindfulness and concentration and wisdom, to see impermanence and conditioning, to avoid getting trapped by the mind, by understanding the mind is also, you know, not me, not mine, not myself. So we avoid getting trapped in our mental states. And then there's the sandbar. What's the sandbar represent? That's the pride or conceit. The I am conceit. Thinking, oh, I'm better than, you know, better meditator than somebody else, or I'm so spiritual, or any number of other types of ego-dominated thoughts that a person could get sort of stuck on that, or any other sort of thoughts of conceit, pride, vanity, and so on. And so again, using mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom to not let the mind get stuck in a negative way on any of these thoughts of I or self. And with each of these kind of stages, you could say this, they, like with each crossing, each advance in the crossing of the river, then you could say like is attaining the stages of the Sotapanna, Sakadagami, you know, the Anagami, and eventually the Arahant. So the Sotapanna especially has to be aware of sensual pleasures and the whirlpools. The once returner has to be especially aware of the eye. And then finally they get close to the other side. What are the branches, tree trunks and sunken branches represent? What? Yes, it represents actually the five, what are called the five higher fetters, which is, for those not familiar with Buddhist terminology, you might not understand that, but basically it means the subtler types of ignorance, as you mentioned, and also subtle pride. These are very subtle things that are still lurking deep in the unconscious that prevent even from have to be transcended for a person to attain full liberation. So anyway, subtle restlessness, ignorance, the thought of I am, and so again, applying more mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, he avoids getting trapped on those and finally reaches the other side. So reaching the other side is a metaphor for attaining the, you know, the full liberation, or, you know, becoming an arahant. That means totally destroyed greed, hatred, and delusion. And is now firmly standing on the further shore of freedom. And then the fruit trees, what does that represent? Of course, it represents the fruits of liberation and also the fruits of meditation, like the higher the ability to attain the jhanas and other exalted deep states of whenever you feel like it. But basically just the fruits of the mind being liberated from lobh, dvesh, and moha, from greed, hatred, and delusion. And then climbing up the little hill and getting a 360-degree view, that's also the view of an arahant. You know, 360 degrees everywhere he looks, this liberation. The mind is not clinging on to any type of, ignorance, and enjoys, life happily ever after. So that's kind of just a metaphor for the nature of life and how we use the Dhamma as a raft to cross the ocean of existence. And so that's what the Buddha advises. The Dhamma is a raft. That means practicing the Noble Eightfold Path, practicing sila, samadhi, and panya, or believing in the aspects of karma and rebirth and things like that, all these various sort of aspects of the Dhamma doctrine. These are all there to help us cross the ocean of greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind, but especially of ignorance. And there's not to be used for, debating others getting famous or using it in some way to get rich or famous and so on. Or get in arguments with people about about who's got the best dharma or which is the best religion. We use it to cross the ocean of suffering in our own mind and don't make it a burden on ourselves or others. So now, having sort of given that little story, I'd like to open it up to any questions that any of you may have about any of those things that we have talked about, or any other relevant Dhamma questions, or also about meditation. Feel free to ask. Don't be shy. Yes.
In your meditation instructions, you mentioned balancing mindfulness and concentration. Are you referring to balancing the seven spiritual faculties?
The seven spiritual faculties? The seven factors of enlightenment? Yes, in a way, but the seven factors of enlightenment, concentration actually comes, as the sixth factor near the end. But I'm referring to the beginning aspect of practice, or the beginning in intermediate levels of practice, about balancing mindfulness and concentration, because there's a lot of talk these days in different meditation circles and practices about people think that mindfulness and concentration are two different things, and the debate about whether you have to practice concentration first to be able to develop mindfulness and wisdom, or others say no, you can just start developing mindfulness and you don't really need much concentration to develop wisdom. So people talk about, oh, I just practice concentration, and other people say, well, I just practice mindfulness or vipassana, as they were two different things. But actually, they're not really two different things, and they have to be really balanced in order for wisdom to be developed. So mindfulness really comes first. Because mindfulness basically means being alert. It means being alert and attentive. So without that, how can you concentrate on something? So in the various instructions that the Buddha gives, especially like in the Satipatthana Sutta, you know, the posture the Buddha mentions about first sitting straight with the posture before even concentrating on breathing. You know, just to sit keeping the back straight. That means you have to be mindful in order to sit and keep your back straight. Because if you start slouching, that means your mind is already going to sleep or is losing its brightness, and it won't become very clear. So you have to be mindful and try to keep straightening the posture to a certain extent. And also, if you're slouching, your breath will become very shallow because your rib cage and lungs are kind of constricted, so the breath can't really come in very easily, so it becomes very faint and weak. So for beginner, it's difficult to notice the breath because it's so faint and weak. So therefore, it should be the mind needs something a little stronger to hold its attention against the onslaught of so many thoughts and other hindrances. So that's why, by keeping the posture straight, it'll allow the breath to come in more fully, and then even like doing deep, slow breathing, which I recommend people to do at the beginning, helps you to feel that breathing process. But anyway, so, and then you use the breath once you've alerted the mind to the posture and can keep the posture fairly straight, then as you start focusing on the breathing, it's more easy to keep the mind feeling the breath. Then the mind focus on the breath helps to develop the concentration. But even while you're doing that, you have to be mindful. That means alert to the things that are trying to steal your concentration. So the mind is always getting distracted by those three things. Either it's going to sleep, or it's getting lost in thoughts, or it's being disturbed by various pains. So as long as you're disturbed by those three things, you're not going to be able to concentrate. So you've got to be mindful of those things. That's a mindfulness is the watchdog. It keeps alert for the various thieves that are trying to steal our mind away. And the concentration always is coming back to focus, to refocus the attention on the breath or the posture itself, because that acts as an anchor to be able to minimize the distracting thoughts. So there's got to be balanced. But in order to get concentrated, the mindfulness has to be there, because otherwise if you're not mindful of the hindrances, you'll never be able to keep your mind focused on the breathing. But if you're just mindful and too much alert, but not sort of calmed by the breathing, then also that mindfulness will become kind of too much excited, or it can be overwhelmed by being aware of too many things. So therefore, by balancing mindfulness and concentration, it creates the perfect sort of combination of the mind being tranquil, but at the same time being alert. So the focusing on the breathing, and the more details you can see of the breathing process and be able to follow the in-breath, the pause, the out-breath, the pause, as many more times as you can follow that without getting lost, then that develops, injects, like injecting a tranquilizer into the nervous system. It sort of tranquilizes the neurotic edge of the nervous system and helps you to sit through pain a lot easier, and it creates a nice kind of light feeling within the body and mind. So that's really sort of the first stage of concentration, is when you're able to have the mind held in place by being aware more and more of the breathing, but at the same time being awake enough to be aware of any potential distractions, and also noticing subtler and subtler things. So those two, it's balancing those two things. If you get too calm and relaxed and not alert enough, the mind can also sink into a kind of a limbo void kind of state, a false kind of samadhi. You're not really sleeping, but you're not really alert either. It's like you smoked a joint of marijuana or something, kind of get spaced out. So you have to avoid that. The mindfulness helps to avoid that. But also, if you don't have that connection with the body and the breathing, then you can get overwhelmed by a lost in thoughts, or get too much sort of distracted by being aware of too many things. Yes?
Okay, Venerable Bhante, I have a question. You know, the meditation, there are some other traditions, like they have like Kundalini meditation, I have heard of those things, and thinking about geometrical shapes and going through the paths of the geometrical figures and stuff like that. That helps to improve your wisdom, or?
Well, that belongs to yogic meditation, although some of those things are found within the Buddhist system of concentration, what are called kasinas, you know, meditating on colored discs and so on, like that red kasina, yellow kasina, green kasina. And they might use those as objects of concentration, but it's only a preliminary technique to concentrate the mind. But normally, those are not used normally. The Buddha wanted to use the natural, what's naturally occurring in our body and mind, such as the breathing or any other purely physical sensations, such as the four elements or the body itself, and not introduce something that's not already kind of there. So that's why you know, we're talking here about the Buddhist meditation practices primarily, not these other forms of yogic meditation or some other types of you get into things like Kundalini and so on, and starts getting off into other you know, those kind of practices may be useful you know, for certain people certain times, but in this context, we're focusing primarily on the advice, the teachings of what the Buddha gave on developing mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom.
Thank you, Venerable Bhante.
Because I know there's lots of fascination out there, especially Westerners or other people. They're fascinated by all these things that they read about, you know, concentration, and about, you know, visualizing this or that, and various powers that can be gotten through various types of concentrations, and it's very alluring. So the greed that normally people have can be transferred onto the greed for getting, you know, mental powers or these other things that you might have read about, the ability to read minds or levitate or whatever you might imagine. You know, it can be greed for that sort of thing, can get a person also sidetracked. So by developing, you know, by following the Satipatthana Sutra, you avoid getting stuck in any of those kind of sidetracks. And that's why the Buddha called this the direct way for the overcoming of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. That the four foundations of mindfulness. And that's why you need the mindfulness and the concentration to not to get caught into some of these various wrong turns or sort of cul-de-sacs of the mind, because it can also unleash a bag of worms that you may not want to get into once you start playing around with the unconscious mind and developing some of these advanced levels of concentration before one is actually ready for that. Because there's lots of examples of people actually damaging themselves by trying to force too quickly, you know, like various types of yogic practices and other things to force the mind to open up before it's ready to. Any other questions? Okay, so I guess we can finish up there.